Good evening, and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Our guest this evening is Mary Reed, highly accomplished art gallery director and lead curator at the Woodstock Art Gallery in Ontario. After earning her Master of Arts in Art History at York University in Toronto, she was curator at the McLaren Art Centre in Ontario, then contemporary art and photography curator for the Winnipeg Art Gallery, followed by a position as director and curator at the School of Art Gallery at the University of Manitoba here in Winnipeg. Mary is also an engaging professor of art history with numerous eloquently written scholarly art publications and articles to her credit. Mary is currently completing her Master of Business Administration degree, specializing in arts and media administration at York University in Toronto. Mary is here with us today to offer her insight on the art of curating. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Oh, it's wonderful to be with you, Susan. Thank you so much for asking me.
Thank you. You're a highly accomplished director, curator, author, an engaging professor, and have been involved with many arts organizations. Going back to when you started out, what drew you into curating, and what was your first exhibition?
Well, Susan, first of all, thank you very much for all those very kind words that you said. I have to say that my exposure to visual arts was very limited as a child. Certainly, you know, loved to draw and loved to create when I was in elementary and high school. And I would take sort of any excuse to be part of that, you know, by taking art in our high school as an elective, being involved in the school play, and particularly doing set design and also costume design. So I think I was very creative, but I wasn't the best artist. In fact, I was pretty poor at it. And it wasn't until I think I was in my senior year of high school that I read a book by Jeffrey Archer, which was not a real critical read. But in it, there was a character in the book, which was a curator or working in an art auction. I can't quite remember the entire story. But basically, that was my first opportunity that I realized that just because I wasn't the best artist, didn't mean that I couldn't have a job in the arts that was different, that would be around organizing or connecting or developing stories and meaningful engagements in a different way. I'd never really, I wasn't exposed enough. My parents didn't take me to art galleries and museums as a child, so I didn't realize that there was this whole other professional world that supported visual practice. And so that was my beginnings of it. And then it wasn't until I was doing my undergraduate work at U of T. First of all, I started off as a commerce student for 2 years, but then I was taking breath requirements, which means you have to take a course outside of your area of study. So I was, of course, drawn to art history and was taking that and failing miserably at calculus and math and accounting. And doing very well at art history. And then it was in my third year of my undergraduate study that I actually switched over. And it was during that time that certainly by studying art history, I became much more aware of not only the history of art and artists, but, you know, the kind of that creation of value, which is through exhibitions. And for me, that became much more interesting and extremely satisfying in that way.
Were there any other particular exhibitions or other curators that may have influenced you as you were starting to curate your own shows over the course of your career?
Sure. So during my, I think it was my second last year at U of T, it took me 6 years to finish my undergraduate degree, which normally takes you 4. So I was there for a bit of an extended period. I had the opportunity to work with Karen Wilkin. Karen Wilkin is an American curator, art historian, and critic. She's based in New York. And it was really that experience as working with her, not only through the class, but as her research assistant, that I understood curatorial work is really a practice, and also understanding the nuts and bolts of how that starts to formulate and develop. And I should say that Karen Wilkin is considered to be a Greenbergian scholar. She really bases her analysis in formal analysis. She really helped me train my eye in terms of looking and asking questions and allowing the artwork to tell you what is going on, and extremely rigorous in terms of her approach and methodology. And I learned a tremendous amount under her while I was working for her.
What drew you into contemporary art and photography?
I guess with the contemporary art, that was the one thing that was very much lacking in terms of my education at the University of Toronto. That was well over 25 years ago, and I'm sure that they have changed the curriculum somewhat. But basically, the history of art kind of ended with that on surrealism, and so there was no sort of real reflection of what was going on around us and what was going around in the day-to-day world. And so it was through my work with Karen Wilkin, which was on the Jack Bush catalog raisonné, and Jack Bush was probably Canada's most important abstract artist in the 50s 50s, 60s, and 70s. He was one of the founders of Painters 11. He was one of the leaders of post-painterly abstraction, and he really brought a lot of this New York abstract expressionist connections up to Canada. And so even though that work, in hindsight, it was very historical, to me it was much more meaningful because I could connect to what was going on because these had just happened a few generations ahead of me. I had a stronger connection and a stronger relevance. So by the time I started doing my graduate work at York University, I really wanted to make contemporary art my focus because I felt maybe perhaps a little bit disconnected to the more historical work.
And having curated exhibitions of varying scales and works in museums, permanent collections, to large-scale group exhibitions, can you tell us about a particularly exciting exhibition you curated and expand on your process for developing the project?
Sure. I mean, while I was working in Winnipeg, I was able to do a number of fantastic exhibitions, which I'm very, very proud of and very pleased of. But I found that, you know, over the course of my time working at the Winnipeg Art Gallery and then eventually working at the University of Manitoba as the director curator of the School of Art Gallery, I really preferred working on solo exhibitions as opposed to kind of larger group exhibitions. And that's not to take away. There are many curators that are very well skilled at the group exhibition, developing the thematic and weaving a narrative through. But I would say that my curatorial practice is more based in collaboration. I really appreciate that exchange with an artist and being able to problem solve together, to weigh out alternatives and options, and to develop a meaningful installation that the artist is proud of, but I'm proud of, achieve certain kind of goals of objectives with the viewing audience. I found that was the most rewarding for me. Over my tenure at the Winnipeg Art Gallery, looking at artists such as Sheila Spence and Wanda Koop and Carolyn Dukes. Those are all very meaningful exhibitions. They were survey exhibitions, with the exception of Carolyn Dukes, working very closely with those artists to be able to, you know, achieve something more than just these are the greatest hits. Really trying to do a deep dive in terms of their academic understanding, their intellectual rigor, and also the research that goes into how they create distinct bodies of work throughout their career. And then moving over to the School of Art, again, working with Bonnie Marin and working with Bev Pike, again, to do those solo exhibitions and really focusing in, because the gallery was smaller and the resources were perhaps a bit more modest, but really trying to focus in on an area of work, of a suite of pieces, and trying to, what I call it, is sort of adding to the archive. So not only looking at the presentation, but also developing a document, be it a visual document, a written document, that sort of solidifies this work in a kind of larger Canadian art history.
How does a visit to the artist studio enhance your preparation and research of the artist, and as you do the collaborative component and work in planning the exhibition?
Sure. Well, I'm very fortunate, Susan, that over my career, I get to go into a lot of artist studios. This is certainly, for me, a very private space. It's a very rarefied space. This is a place where artists are working through ideas, are struggling, are getting somewhere, then rejecting it, coming back. So I really do feel that my time in artist studios is extremely privileged, and I try to enter that space with that mindset. To me, it's akin of asking somebody to read something that I've half written and maybe haven't even had a chance to edit it yet. When you're, you know, kind of working through all those excellent ideas, trying to make that happen can be very scary, and it's not finalized, right? But you're still working on it. So for me, normally when I do a studio visit with an artist, when it's the first time, really it's the get-to-know-you meeting, right? You have an opportunity to have a little conversation, you look at the recent work, and perhaps maybe have a few questions or look at some kind of older pieces. But it's just that more of initial introduction. When I'm working on when, you know, the commitment has been made, and this is usually after two or three studio visits, you know, looking at work in progress, then what happens is those becomes much more rigorous meetings. There's an agenda, we're working out various logistics and details, and then also having to do the hard part, which is really starting to make some key decisions on what gets included. That's the easy part. But the hard part is what gets excluded. So a lot of that is negotiating, and a lot of that is kind of considering, trying to visualize the placement of the works in the space, and also trying to resist that impulse to include everything if there isn't room for everything, because that will just overwhelm it. So it's difficult, it's frustrating, it's wonderful, it's magical, it's all of those things that what takes place in the artist studio.
You've certainly given us a great deal of information on behind-the-scenes aspects of curating that people aren't aware of when they see the finished exhibition. And additionally, are the exhibition catalogs a significant part of the overall scheme of an exhibition? And can you give us an example?
Sure, Susan. So I look at the exhibition catalog as, you know, a project that runs in tandem, right? And I should say this, any type of publication or anything that is printed that people take away, I don't necessarily look at it as a means to document the project. I really do look at it as something to enhance what people are looking at and engage with. But I also am very cognizant that this document, it can be just a small brochure to a coffee table book, is what is going to stand the test of time in terms of that exhibition. But I do see them as parallel projects, and I do see them as almost two distinct projects where this idea of curating comes in place. So although you may arrange a series of paintings in a square, in a gallery space, and you have reasons for why work X is against work Y and why work A is across from work B, those types of relationships don't necessarily translate into a printed form. And so you're almost rethinking about how the artwork is presented in that reading format. And then also you have the opportunity to provide much more in-depth and extensive text that your reader is now engaging with. And so you have to be very mindful that if you are referring to painting X, that they're not having to go dig down 20 pages within the catalog to get it, that in fact it's reproduced either on the page beside it or a page preceding it. So it really is like a different form of curating in a two-dimensional way where there is that prescribed process of reading from one page to the next to the next. So that's how I see them. In terms of their significance, the reality is that, you know, an exhibition is extremely temporal. So once it leaves, it leaves. What we're left with is the publication. So although the publication doesn't necessarily mirror what the exhibition is, it's the thing that's left standing to give you the flavor or an insight of what the exhibition represented.
In terms of in-depth and extensive publications and writings about the life and work of an artist, you also wrote a widely renowned publication on Anthony Caro, Drawing in Space, which is eloquently and insightfully written and one of a 5-volume series on the artist and his sculpture. What was your experience researching and writing this book on such an innovative and globally recognized British artist?
So that was an amazing experience, Susan, and it was an incredibly intense experience. So it's interesting to see how your contacts stay with you and how they continue to support you. So it was actually through my connection with Karen Wilkin. By this point, you know, I was well into my professional career, and she reached out to me because she was the editor of this 5-volume series and offered me the opportunity to do volume 1, which was on his early work called Drawing in Space. So the works that are straddling from the late 1940s well up into about just touching into 1970. So one, it was a terrific opportunity to work under Karen Wilkin again, but two, there was also the opportunity to work directly with Anthony Caro, the opportunity to meet with him, correspond with him directly, go to his studio, meet his studio assistant, see the raw material, profound experience, because here I am dealing with this master sculptor at the end of his career, still pushing the boundaries, still making these enormous large-scale sculptures. He's well into his 80s at this point, but at the same time asking him to think back to when he was really fundamentally changing the direction of sculpture, the way that we view contemporary art, by eliminating the base, using man-made materials, incorporating high-key colors, yellows, blues, magentas, greens to cover the work. So it was quite remarkable that here you could see he was extremely focused on the present, but at the same time was very reflective on what had happened 40, 50 years before that.
You also contributed to things like the MAWA, the Mentoring Artists for Women's Arts, and Arts and Cultural Industries Association of Manitoba and Winnipeg. What did this work involve, and what did you find most rewarding about this experience?
I have to say that anybody who lives in Manitoba or anybody who lives in Winnipeg is so unbelievably fortunate to have MAWA within their mix. It is probably my favorite organization by far, and have such tremendous esteem for the people who lead MAWA and for everybody who's involved with MAWA. And I should also say that Cultural Industries Association of Manitoba does an exceptional job as well. But it really is that power of mentoring that I believed very strongly when I came to Winnipeg, was certainly honed and developed as through my experience through MAWA, and is something that has stayed with me as I've moved forward in my professional career. And it's the mentoring that is just so significant, this idea of paying it forward. And because of my experience of being a professional mentor at MAWA, as well as through arts and cultural industries, this is something that I continue to do, not only as an instructor at Fanshawe College, but also in my role here as a director curator of the Woodstock Art Gallery. So I professionally and informally mentor my team members, but we also are very fortunate that every summer and then once a year, we bring in students as well as graduate interns. And so they work through a six-week mentoring process with me, which is basically very similar to one that we did at MAWA. It's not about the work that they're working on for the gallery. It's about their own personal career development and where do they want to see themselves and how do they want to position themselves. And it's transformational for many of these young people, many of them women, not only in terms of confidence awareness, but also on their understanding of what's out in front of them, how they feel once they finish that process with a much well-stocked toolkit and the ability to take on the world with that. I'm very selfish into that. People go, why do you expend all this energy? I said, well, these are the cultural leaders of tomorrow. If I can somehow give them a leg up, give them the tools and the information that they need to make a difference, then all of the work that I'm doing today, I know that that legacy will continue, and they then will also continue to pay that forward, so that 20 years from now, when they're in their position, they will remember what I've done, and that they will then impart their wisdom and knowledge onto the future generation of cultural workers.
Any exciting exhibitions coming up for Woodstock Art Gallery?
We're just about to actually change over everything. We have two exhibitions that I'm actually quite pleased about. So one of them will be on the fourth floor. One of them will be on the first floor. The fourth floor is still empty warehouse space here at the gallery, so it's my Freudian slip that I wanted to get. I'm constantly looking for money to renovate it, so I apologize for that. So the first floor is dedicated to our permanent collection. In the last couple of years, we've brought in a number of works by renowned sculptor John McEwen, who works primarily in canine but in animal images. So we're going to be doing an exhibition of his work recently donated by a former resident of Woodstock, who's an avid collector of his work, to the gallery. But to augment that exhibition, John is loaning us one of his brand new pieces, which is a full-scale Clydesdale horse, all made out of those tiny Corten steels that he welds together to create that. This thing is just absolutely massive and unbelievably impressive. So I'm very excited about that. And the exhibition is called Walk On, which he's very excited about. And then on the second floor, my interest in abstraction comes out again. This is a co-production that we did with the Art Gallery of Burlington, looking at contemporary abstract practice from two different generations. So it's featuring the work of Patrick Tiber. Patrick Tiber is in his mid-70s and has been wrestling with abstraction for close to 45, 50 years. He's a former professor at Fanshawe College. And so he's done these really outstanding, I would call kind of reliefs almost, these kind of large planes of color. And then we've paired him with Dale Hildebrand. And Dale Hildebrand may be familiar to some of you guys because he's originally from Steinbach, Manitoba. He now lives in Montreal. And I did feature Dale's work in an exhibition at the School of Art Gallery, I think in 2012. He does these very intricate, large-scale abstract pieces. So again, Dill's in his early 40s. There's about 35, 40 years that separate the two artists. So just a different take on abstraction, moving not only from the formal aspects of it, but looking at the inspiration of it as well, too. And that exhibition is called Dancing on the Grave, and the title of that is because they're dancing on the grave of abstraction.
Well, I'd like to thank you so much for taking the time to share your story and invaluable insight to curating contemporary art. And I wish you continued success, especially on your upcoming exhibitions.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Susan, and thank you so much for all your interest.
Thank you. That was Mary Reed, Art Gallery Director and Lead Curator at the Woodstock Art Gallery in Ontario. For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to Art World Innovators on UMFM 101.5. Our guest this evening is renowned sculptor Anna Sofia Maug, raised in the Swedish province of Dalarna. Anna Sofia has a diverse portfolio of works, ranging from small elegant ceramics to large-scale outdoor installations and innovative ice sculptures. Anna Sofia made her first artwork for Ice Hotel in 2006, the Hotel of Ice and Snow, 200 kilometers north of the Arctic Circle in Jukkasjärvi in Sweden. Returning almost every winter since then, she has created six art suites on her own, been involved in several Ice Hotel's art projects, and taught ice sculpting during the winter seasons. Anna Sofia graduated with an applied art and ceramics ceramics, Master of Fine Art from the School of Design and Crafts from the Gutenberg University in Sweden, and attended the School of Crafts at Leksand. Her works have been exhibited in group and solo shows throughout Sweden and internationally, such as in China, the US, Belgium, France, Germany, Russia, and Korea. Her works are held in numerous collections, such as the National Museum of Fine Arts in Stockholm, Sweden, and the World Ceramic Center in South Korea, the National Public Art Council of Sweden, and others. She has been written about in various ceramics publications, the Ice Hotel magazine, and received a number of prestigious awards and grants. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for letting me be on the air.
You have a very diverse portfolio of beautifully crafted works, and your ice sculptures have captured global attention at the Swedish Ice Hotel in Nykasjärvi. Sculpting in ice must require a unique skill set with a rhythmic carving touch. Can you describe one of your ice sculptures and the process as it unfolds from design to completion?
Well, I usually have an idea that sits for quite some time. And recent years, it has been an animal. And I'm just kind of get into that animal's nature. So basically, I'm just collecting images about it. And then I try to sculpt it in a small version, in clay. I'm a ceramist, so clay is a natural material to use. And it's easy to shape. And then I upscale it when I go big in ice and snow.
And can you describe one of your pieces for us?
Well, one of the latest one I did was Elephant in the Room at Ice Hotel, and it was an art suite, which is, it's a piece of art, but it's also a hotel room for guests where they stay over the night. And I just wanted to put this huge life-size elephant in snow and ice inside the room, which it could just barely fit in there. I had to fit in a bed also, so I had to cut the elephant a little bit in half. In order to get it in. So, yeah, it's a huge African savanna elephant, one of the biggest mammal, I think, in the world right now. And it was kind of naturally sculpted in snow.
Would you like to tell us how you became an ice hotel sculptor and what has been most exhilarating and exciting about your adventures working with the other artists on these projects?
Well, back in 2006, I had been working as a professional artist, basically in ceramics, for 5 years after my master's degree. And I lived in the region, the same county where Ice Hotel is situated. And I've been there visiting the hotel many times as a tourist. And when I realized, oh, well, there are real artists coming here and doing this, I applied myself. I found out that they have a jury and they want artists to apply from all over the world with a concept and an idea. And I did, and I got in. That was my first time, yeah.
And what was it like working with other artists from around the world and working on this type of sculpture?
Yeah, that's a new experience, since in my own studio, working as a potter or ceramist, I need a lot of time to be alone to work, actually, to produce art. But at Ice Hotel, that's like a big meeting place and one of the biggest art projects actually in Sweden every year. So meeting artists also not maybe based in clay or ceramics, but it can be any material or architect is very exciting. So you widen your own horizon as an artist in that sense.
And did it lead you to other large-scale works that you worked on that you have exhibited in public places or in galleries?
It has led to, I've been working a bit with public commissions in Sweden and increasing the scale. With clay, you are limited to the size of the kiln to fire your piece. But I discovered I can fire parts and put them together after the firing.
How did you start out in your practice, and what were some of the things you discovered that allowed you to branch into so many different styles and materials like mosaics and pottery, as well as the other things like ice sculptures?
It may seem like a wide range, but I really see a thread going through all this. I started with clay. First, I started at an art school. Mm-hmm. In Sweden, we have a lot of pre-art school before the university. And in one of those, I went for a year and I tried all kinds of materials, clay, metal, wood, textile. and I got a bit hooked. And I must say, it was the throwing on the wheel that got my attention. It's something with just sit and try to make a bowl or a cup on the wheel. So that was the start. And then I focused more and more on clay. So I ended up with this master degree in applied art in ceramics a few years later. And going from there to ice and snow, I would say as a kid, I was always the one playing with clay, or at winter time, because I'm lucky to be brought up in a winter landscape, I could mold the snow and have fun. Okay. And basically that's what I continue doing at Ice Hotel.
You've returned to your hometown to teach at the Luksen Folkhögskola. What do you enjoy most about sharing your experiences and discoveries with your students?
The thing is, going back to this school is also discovering how much I learned since I left that school. And I have to constantly remind myself to limit a little bit of the knowledge that I teach out. I have to start in another level, because otherwise it would be too difficult for the students. So, but what I enjoy the most is now I've done 1 year and now I'm following. This means that many of the students, they go 2 years, and now I'm following the second graders. I've been with them 1 year and now I'm following them into the second year, and to see how they evolve, how their work evolve, and how they understand, and all of a sudden they can use what I tried to teach them half a year ago. It's like they are discovering things. So that is the most amazing thing, to see these people grow in a way, artistically. It's really fantastic. And I haven't done that before. So in a way, I completely turned this around from my own artist ego to focus on the students and their processes.
Do you have any exhibitions coming up or any exciting sculptures planned that you'd like to tell us about?
No, just for my garden. Gosh, I have a small farm now. I'm living the dream, the life of my dreams right now. We managed to purchase a small house in a beautiful area, and it's an old farm from 400 years ago. So an old garden, and I just keep moving around my sculptures in the garden. I think it will come in time. I've been moving my studio a lot also around this area, around Ice Hotel up in the north of Sweden. It's also a mining area. We have a mining industry. So I've been moving my studio a lot, and a ceramic studio is very heavy, a lot of things. And right now, by moving and changing life, my studio is not up and running at this moment, but it will be in time. So it's more like I'm doing all these steps so I can be creative in my own studio. Maybe within a year or 2 years, we will see. But apart from that, it's the school and it's ceramic, so I'm surrounded with a lot of ceramic nerds, which is good. And also the contact with Ice Hotel, so I could go up there and do more projects. And I have some projects that my brain is cooking, but they are not ready to go out yet.
Well, we'll look forward to when they do come out. It will be really interesting to see them. And I'd like to thank you so much for speaking with us today and taking the time to share your insight and story with us. It's been a pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you. My pleasure also.
Thank you. That was sculptor Anna-Sofia Maug speaking with us from her home in Sweden. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more on today's innovators in the art world.